Okay. Can I be heard? Can people hear me out there? In there? I'm going to launch the chat room. That's the next thing I've got to do. Launch chat here. Okay. That should be opening now. Sorry, I'm still new at all this. And, of course, I'm doing all kinds of things all the time, and I never really think about this until right when this show's supposed to start. And it's, oh, my God, the show's supposed to start. Can I be heard? Am I audible out there? Are these headphones working? I need to check and find out if this is working. Is it? Is there anybody? Can anyone hear me? It'd be great if I could see. Oh, the chat room isn't finished loading yet. What is going wrong with this? I had just the most difficult time trying to load this. Log in and get this thing working today. It's probably a 50-50 me and it problem. And I'm thinking Don may call in, and then when he does, I'm hoping I can figure out how to get him to join the show. But I'm expecting him anytime, and it will be fantastic to hear his take on many of the things. We haven't had a chance to speak for several weeks now. And I know he's got a lot to say, and a lot's happened. And there's a few issues that we left hanging the last time we spoke, and I know that Don wanted to get into them. A lot of it has to do with the notion of radicalization, and I think he wanted to talk about it. I certainly have my own ideas about it, which I did mention last week on the show, actually. So as far as the American midterms go, I only have one short thing to say about it, and that is, it is far less important than the Republicans win, than which Republicans win. Same goes with Democrats. There's lots of Democrats I would rather see win this thing than certain Republicans. So we have infiltration on both sides of that camp. I don't know if anyone's listening, but Frank Gaffney at Center for Security Policy, for those that don't know him, Frank Gaffney was Under Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan, a pretty serious guy. And he did a 10-part course. This is some serious watching, yeah? You're not going to want to do this all in one day. But if you wanted to educate yourself on the Muslim Brotherhood in America, this is still topical. I mean, this course is like a year old or more, but it is absolutely just as germane now as it was when it was done. So I'm going to put the link to that course here. I think I'll post it a little later on too, but again, this will show that if you watch this course, you realize that Republican Democrats, from the point of view of people whose primary concern is the influence of Islam in the Western world, the United States in particular, unfortunately, the infiltration is just about as intense on both sides. In fact, it appears that many Muslim organizations focused on the Republican side a lot more than the Democrat side because, for obvious reasons, it was much more important to do so since the Democrats were practically on board anyway. I mean, it was the Frankfurt School thought political correctness and so on was working so well in Islamic advantage that, well, there wasn't really much need to work that hard at infiltrating them. And, of course, look at Huma Abedin and so on and so on, and you realize, well, they're right there at the top. But the Republicans, they have some very key people that are totally at the beck and call of people whose interests are not American interests, but most definitely Sharia and Islamic ones. So I think you'll find that course, to be quite specific, exactly which Republicans are problematic and why they are problematic. And there is a, I think it's a preponderance, I think it's the word, of evidence showing why these particular, I mean, you can't, a fellow like Frank Gaffney's not going to name names unless he's confident that the evidence is so overwhelming that there's not going to be any danger of a lawsuit or that any other kind of legal problem from doing so, right? So that's about all I've got to say about the midterms. Let's just hope it's the right ones to get in. I doubt many people do as much research as necessary to make those kinds of voting choices, but, you know, let's hope they did. So let's have a look at some of the items that are, I mean, the degree of what we consider horrifying has now escalated so amazingly much that what a few years ago would have been considered a horrifying and important story today is business as usual. As Ezra Levant would say, it's the new normal. ISIS is executing women and children, wholesale. 36 Sunni tribesmen, women and children, pushing the number of members slain by the extremists in recent days to more than 200. So Islamic State continues to behave in an Islamically correct way. I think that's important to note, right? I think we might actually be able to get a call from someone who can really give us some good, solid information on what these midterms mean and which people to listen for. So anybody who might be listening, just sit tight. I think this is going to pick up pretty soon. I'm sorry, I'm not more organized. It's just one of those things where, you know, I'm doing what it is I've got to do up to the right up to the second that it's like, oh my God, it's time to get on do this show. So far though, it's come together nicely. I'm just hoping I can figure out how to answer the phone when it does ring. What else have we got? Former Muslim Brotherhood member. Inside every Brotherhood member is an Islamic State member. Well, I mean, I'm glad to hear one of them say it, but I think we all knew that, right? I can't really see any distinction there. I don't think they're like rival motorcycle gangs. I'm pretty sure they're just different names working for the same exact cause. Let's see now. Do we have our guest on the phone? Let me have a look. Any second now. there is somebody that appears to be on hold. Let me see if I can make this work. Hello?
Hey, Vlad.
Ah, brilliant. It's Baron at Gates of Vienna. Thank you for calling in. Listen, I really was hoping you'd have some things to say about the midterms that are going to be refreshing and a little bit more interesting than the kind of very banal, damp analysis that I'm hearing out there. It clearly matters more which individuals get in than which party they represent. Is that, would you say that's true?
You don't want to get me started on Republicans.
Actually, I kind of do, because
I hate Republicans. The only thing worse than a Republican is a Democrat.
Right. So what's your analysis of what's going on and the consequences of what today's vote?
Well, the mood is throw the rascals out, and that's why the Republicans are doing well. And they, you know, I'm sure they think they're doing well because of their wonderful policies, but they don't, if they think that, they don't understand the mood in the country. There's only a few Tea Party people getting in, I think. I'm not sure about that. The big one was here in Virginia where Bratt beat out Eric Cantor in the primary and is running in the general. I haven't looked at the results tonight. I don't know how he's doing. That's for Congress.
Okay.
But the mood is throw the rascals out. That's what this is all about. People are loathing the party in power.
Why do you think that is? Like, really, why do you think that is?
It's a variety of things. Obamacare is deeply unpopular, right? A good majority of people hate Obamacare. But the Republicans, at last I heard, aren't planning to repeal it. And then there's ISIS in the Middle East and all that stuff. But there's just a lot of different things. Obama is more government and more regulations and more tyrannical behavior. And it's just gathering strength now. Supposedly we're in a recovery, right? But on individual experience level, everybody's having serious trouble. A lot of people are. The real unemployment rate is higher than the official one because they fudge the figures. And if you go around and talk to people, most people are in one way or another having economic trouble. So there's definitely a lot of discontent, at least in my experience.
So because typically it seems like no matter what's going on in the country, the elections are usually determined by the economy. And in this case, it's possible that it's not the case, right? In this case, it may actually be much, much deeper than that because there's so many things that Obama has done which concern Americans. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah. The economy is part of it, but there's a lot of other stuff. And what we're seeing now is that it doesn't really matter which party is in power for a lot of issues. Mass immigration over the southern border is deeply unpopular. People want the border enforced, but neither party wants to do it for their own reasons. And I already mentioned the other things that are unpopular, but neither party is inclined to do anything about, like Obamacare. We're going to get health care regulated and government mandated, whether people want it or not. I can't always tell you why those things are, because whatever the powerful interests are that are engaging various Congress beings and influencing them are beyond my ken. But there must be some big money behind Obamacare. There must be some big money behind more immigrants. And then there's the Muslim Brotherhood all to contend with while we're at it.
Speaking of which, have you seen the 10-part video course by Center for Security Policy on Muslim Brotherhood in American government?
You mean the Steve Coughlin thing?
No. It's a 10-part course.
Frank Gaffney's thing?
Frank Gaffney's thing, yeah.
Yeah, I remember it. That came out a while back, right?
Probably 2 years. I'd say it's probably a year and a half, 2 years. But I think it's probably every... In fact, that would have been great for people to see that before they went to go vote, because it actually showed the tremendous amount of infiltration and subversion by Muslim Brotherhood of both parties, and named names. And I think that would have been terrifically useful for people. It looks like there's another call or two. If I'm reading the board right, it's all ones across the board, so I don't know what it means. Let's find out. Is there somebody there?
Is this? Am I on there?
Yes, you are. That sounds like Don.
Yeah, so, it is. It is. Go ahead. How are you this evening, there, Vlad?
I'm good overall. All things being considered, pretty good. Thanks. How about you?
I take it you've got the Baron on as well.
Yes, we're all here. And I think there was something that we wanted to discuss, and that was, this is something because the Baron actually had a great article up on Gates of Vienna about this called The Great Lie. And I think it's a really important issue. I know it's one you wanted to discuss, Don, and that has to do with this issue of radicalization, which governments are always anxious to claim is the problem. They don't even say radical what. Like, the problem is just being a radical. It's not being a radical Buddhist or a radical street sweeper or radical curling fan. The problem is just being a radical. So radicalization is this great word everybody uses to avoid the issue, as if somehow becoming a radical is what's make you likely to spend 15 days at a homeless shelter trying to get everybody to pray to Allah five times a day, then go shoot a Canadian soldier at a national monument. Now, I know that you had some ideas, and I carefully avoided discussing them with you off air because I wanted to hear them now. And I know that Baron has some ideas. So do you want to start with that, Don? Because I know it's something you were thinking about.
I'll defer to the Baron and let him lead off here, and then I'll listen here and then follow his lead there when he's done. I'll sort of take cue from his comments.
Oh, I'd rather hear what you have to say, Don.
I don't know really where to start. I'm not sure. You know, I'm listening to what you're saying about radicalization. I'm not really sure what sort of conversation we're looking for here. What I guess with me, the word radical is simply an apple in the basket of many apples that's used by mass media, mainstream media, liberal government, and essentially those people who are in a perpetual state of denial. Radical is a word used that we can use along with things like extremist, Islamist, and then of course there's the classic favorite of Robert Spencer, and that's the great misunderstanders. And I think even Robert Plant could probably do a song on that as well. But the bottom line is that Islam is Islam, and what we're seeing now is not Islam light. It's not radically misunderstanding Islam. It's not an extremist form of Islam. What we're seeing playing out in the Middle East is a mirror image of what happened back in 632 AD. This is pure, 100% unadulterated Islam. That's what it is. So there's nothing radical about it. When we're talking about radicals, if you want to be talking about radicals along the line, let's say vigilantes, it's that denial of what we're facing. It's that refusal to kind of look straight into the jaws of Islam itself, and much to our own injury, that's creating concern across North America and throughout Europe, and that's giving rise to a lot of groups that are small in nature now or small in size now that are rising and doing what government refuses to do. And that's starting to organize and plan sort of pushback actions against the tide of Islam. So you're dealing with normalized Islam, and then you're dealing with the natural consequence of government befuddlement and law enforcement, law enforcement complicity, if you will, and sort of judicial silence, to throw that in there. So I guess that's where I'm at on that.
Okay, so I guess what I'm looking for more has to do with what the actual motives are. I mean, yes, I think there's not going to be any disagreement of the three of us that
the motives with respect to what? With respect to terminology or with respect to what do you see ISIS doing in the Middle East?
Neither, actually. I'm actually just heading toward that answer. What I mean is, what would motivate a comfortable Muslim teenager living in Canada to suddenly go become a jihadi to fight for the Islamic State? I mean, the answer obviously is Islam, but there's more to the answer.
Oh, okay. All right. Sorry.
And this
sorry.
Is something that we discussed before.
Yeah, excuse my obtuseness. I think what we're looking at, and I'm the Baron's read some of my writings, and so have you, and I tend to be a big fan and manufacturer of hot-winded hysterical hyperbole and inflammatory flatulent rhetoric. That aside, I think what we're looking at is we're looking at the natural consequence of the feminization of North American Western society. I'll point to sort of. Hopefully, I won't be too fractured here. I'll point to a couple of examples. You take a look at recently in Europe, the millions and millions of people who turned out at one of those, I think it's a Europe's Got Talent or something like that, or Europe Music Festival. And you had the winner of that was a transvestite, bearded man that is supposed to be a woman. And this was just took everybody's breath away. It played center stage throughout Europe. You had government, kings, monarchy, the heads of countries, heads of state, fawning and laying out a red carpet for what amounts to a pervert in a nice dress. I'm looking for the words here, but this is what Europe has come down to. We have come far from adventurers, kings, generals, manly men, seeking out new worlds, exploring new worlds on the frontiers, and we've now gathered in front of televisions to celebrate perverts in fancy sequin dresses. It's the feminization. Children go to school today, and young men go to school today, and they're looking for something masculine. It's in their nature. It's a cornerstone of who they are. And they know deep down inside that there's something missing. They look at the armed forces, and the armed forces is feminized. Like, for example, in the Canadian forces, if you're a recruit, if you don't like the way you're being spoken to, there's a carding system. I believe it's a white card, red card, and a yellow card or something like this. You don't like the way you're being spoken to, you simply raise a card, and your instructor immediately has to cease all contact and move away until you gather your senses. I mean, we are not now the men that we used to be. There is nothing. I hate to say it, but in many ways we have lost our greatness with respect to our masculinity, with respect to our strength. And young men know this. Young men who are growing up in this world, many of them know this. They look around them and they sit in classrooms, and they have a man standing in the front of the classroom who's extolling the joys of one man jamming his fist into another man's anus. And yet people like Columbus, are demonized. People of strength and of courage are ridiculed and mocked. So they look over, and I'm trying not to be too much of a psychologist, psychiatrist. They look over to the Middle East, and they look at our entertainment, if you will, and our political infrastructure and the spineless nature of our government and our academic system. They take a look at the feminized nature of that. They look across the Middle East, and here they have men who are men. They don't apologize for it. These guys have that wild look in their eyes. They have the long hair, the beards. They draw the line in the sand, and they say, this is our line in the sand. You cross it, we're going to kill you. And they do, with great gusto. They don't play games. There's no line that moves back and forth. There's no, well, we're going to draw the line here, and then you're going to get to the line, and then we'll reconsider, and we'll move the line back here. These are a true, if you want to call it that way, a band of brothers. Yes, they're bloodthirsty. Yes, they're barbaric. But there is a masculinity and a take-no-prisoners appeal to that. And you compare that to what we've become in the West, and young men who are looking for strength and leadership look to what's unfolding in the Middle East, and they say, I want to be a part of that. That's what I want to be a part of. I don't want to be a part of spinelessness. I don't want to be part of perversion. I don't want to be a part of an obscuring of the line between the sexes. I don't want to be a part of judges who can't pass sentence on those people who have done wrong. I don't want to be part of moral decay. I want strength in my society. I want strength in the people that I live with. And they have it over. They have it over in the Middle East. And I think that's in large part what our young people are looking at. They look over there and they say, I want some of that, as opposed to what we have over here. Now, I could be terribly wrong, and then Baron's probably going to beat the crap out of me intellectually for the ponderings, but that's it in a rather large nutshell.
Baron?
Yeah?
Would you like to add anything to that?
Well, what it all makes me think about is, I kind of remember being young. Young men want to be bad. The sympathy for the devil syndrome you know. It makes me think of that song. I only know the covers of it. Do you know it, Ed Vlad, called Who Do You Love? George
yes.
Thorogood covered it.
Yes.
That's what ISIS is appealing to all over the world, is that in all, well, not all young men, but all, most young men, you know, are like that at some point in their lives. Just 22, and I don't mind dying. And when you catch them at the right moment, you can reel them in, and I think that's happening. You know, guys that are on the edge and doing a lot of different kinds of dope, they see that stuff, they hear that stuff, and it's so bad, it's just what they always wanted to do. That's my theory.
Well, there's also, I actually think that we're all discussing different elements. I don't think any one of these is a sum total of it. There's certainly a number of elements. And another element would be, I think this is the reason why most university students are communists. It's because the scariest thing in the average North American European's life is the idea of leaving school, having to get a job and pay your own bills. And I think it's utterly mortifying. And so a lot of them gravitate to communism because they think, okay, well, rather than have to depend on my own abilities to sustain myself and have to make sacrifices and choose what I want and don't want based on, you know, what's left after paying the rent and food, you know, I think I shouldn't have to. I think that we should be able to go out there and take money from people that have a lot and just distribute it among us. I think that most communist sympathies are motivated by fear of independence, and then you get past it, and then most people stop being communist when they realize, wait a minute, I understand generation of wealth, and I understand paying my own way, and I understand that this money is now mine, I've earned it, and that I don't want governments taking it from me to pay for the CBC, for instance. Unless, of course, you have a job like with the government, where you're being paid a ludicrous amount of money and not have to produce wealth, and then you never lose that communist mentality. So the same thing applies. If you offer people this other thing and you say, well, you can just go, we'll give you a house, and you'll never have to worry about being rejected by a girl you like. You can just buy one, or we'll give you one, and food is free, and all you got to do is support this ideology and fight for us. And, you know, if you die, well, you get this ridiculous afterlife, which the more I think about it, the more horrifying. Anybody who's ever lived with a couple of sisters would know that, like, sharing one bathroom with 72 virgins is actually hell. I think that's these are all reasonable factors which added up are going to, and then of course, I mean, we're all avoiding the one because we all understand that it's given, right? And that's Islam. But I think that where I was going to about this before had to do with I think your article was called The Big Lie. Do you want to detail that?
Was it called The Big Lie? Oh, ISIS and the Big Lie. Yeah.
Yes.
I did write something. But that was a few days ago. How would I remember that? Let's see if I can load it up here. What you said while you're waiting, though, what you said about the ISIS and their virgins and all that, did you hear what they're doing with their sex slave market, their slave market? This just came out today. I don't have a link handy, but apparently the entrepreneurs were out there competing with each other and driving down the price, and the caliph issued an edict saying that strict price controls on slaves had to be maintained. Did you hear about that, Vlad?
No, but that is really, yeah. Really peculiar.
And the prices were too low, and the caliphate was losing revenue, and it gave a price structure, mandatory price structure for slaves based on age group. 40 to 50 was the lowest price, then 30 to 40, 20 to 30, and so on. And the highest price was for, I don't remember if it was 0 to 10 or what, it was young girls anyway, the youngest girls. And anybody who didn't adhere to this price structure, the mandatory punishment was execution.
Whoa.
And Now, mind you, I don't know how true this was. It's just something you read, right? But it's just we're here in 2014 reading this stuff. It's really weird.
It's not really. I mean, it is really weird, but it's a moment that's so surreal and so otherworldly as to you have a hard time believing that it's actually happening. I mean, we're sitting here and having a conversation about slave trade and like the Baron said in 2014. And it's stunning that we're even having this conversation.
Yeah, and even if this particular part isn't true, there is a slave trade. They have slave markets, and they are selling women, Yazidi and Christian women, and it's just astonishing. And then you hear everybody read everybody in the news stories, hear them on the news reports, focusing on the Israeli settlements in the West Bank, you know, while slaves are being sold in Raqqa and Mosul and all those places.
When you think about that, how thin is the line that divides us from a reversion to barbarism and this state of enlightenment that we like to think we're all in? I mean, it seems to be a precarious balancing act that we're doing right now.
Well, Vlad, I have the article open, the essay open now, ISIS and the Big Lie. You and I had talked about this stuff quite a bit, and some of it came up in the comments today. I can't remember who it was, comments at Gates of Vienna. Somebody said, just think how violent Islam would be if it weren't the religion of peace. And that's the big lie, anyway, is religion. Is that Islam is not inherently a violent ideology.
Sorry, that's one of the funniest things I've heard in quite a while.
Yeah, it's a good one.
If you think it's violent now, imagine how violent it would be if it wasn't the religion of peace. Oh, my God, that's very funny. Sorry,
everything
continue.
Bad Islam does has nothing to do with Islam. Everything good Islam does has to do with Islam.
So
and
nothing
of course,
has
most
to do
of
with
the,
Islam, then.
The good things are mostly just the things I talk about on TV. You can't find much in the way of reality that's good about it. You know, they feed widows and orphans sometimes, but only if they're already Islamic.
Yes. So, but the point, I think the point was just that it occurs to me that a lot of these people are. A lot of young Muslims in the Western world are likely to become resentful that they're being lied to by all of our governments and all of the government-sponsored imams, Russia-style. But, I mean, they have them in England. They have them everywhere. They have all these imams that are taking government funds to at least publicly represent Islam the way our governments want it represented, not as it is, hoping that they can fool people into thinking Islam is what they want it to be and not what it is, which I find to be an absolutely preposterous strategy right from the gate.
Do they do that in Canada?
Not at the government level, but most certainly at the propaganda level of the CBC, which even though the CBC is a government entity, there is no relationship between CBC's attitudes and policies and the actual government of Stephen Harper. They're, in fact, very much at odds. And if Harper, I suspect, would probably like to defund it altogether, but it's not that easy to do. But so that's an interesting thing. It's not like the UK, where the BBC seems to be very much in lockstep with the government's official position on most important things. I don't know how they structured it, but I guess the government's really able to frighten the management of BBC into doing what they don't even like. My guess is that BBC senior personnel are aware of reality and would rather not represent it that way. And the evidence, I think, was the girl who called a cab for her daughter, a senior BBC manager, and said, "Just don't send me a Muslim," and got fired for it. But
then there's the pork barbecue they had in their courtyard.
Yeah, so I think the BBC probably, I think that the British and Canadian situation are quite different that way, in that our government was instantly called an Islamic terrorist attack, a terrorist attack, and then as soon as the RCMP were comfortable with the data, with the evidence, they said it was about Islam and religion and Allah, and they, even though they haven't released the guy's martyr video yet, but they may have other reasons. There may be forensic evidence in there that they don't want public just yet, because they may not, maybe they still think they
can. Yeah, like where he was when he made it, for example.
Yeah, and they don't, exactly, if they make it public, people are going to go, oh my God, you got to move this or stop that or whatever have you. So, you know, but the CBC, of course, is doing its level best to preserve that sort of that ridiculous narrative, and I think that this is the important thing here is it's a complete like not dealing with reality. It's very rarely a good strategy. I mean, I do think that life does contain a bunch of inherent necessary illusions without which things won't go well. I accept that, but when you're trying to actually set policy, like pretending Ebola is not contagious, for instance, I think that's a bad policy. People are going to get sick and people are going to die. And pretending that Islam isn't the ideology that's motivating people. So, but in this particular case, I'm talking about one very tiny fraction of this entire thing. And it has to do with the idea that by telling the public that Islam isn't what it is, and that you're, and meanwhile letting in millions of Muslims who either know what it is, or they have kids who've been raised here and basically are noticing that Islam is the number one news item now. I mean, you remember when you started blogging this, and even when I started blogging about this some years later than you did, it really wasn't in the news much. And when we saw a video, when I first started Vlad Tepes' blog, any video I could find on YouTube that dealt with this issue in a reasonable way was a precious find. Like collecting them was a big deal, and making them was great, you know. And now, of course, you just have to turn on Fox or even CNN to see stuff regularly, and BBC. Everybody now, I mean, Islam has become the number one concern.
It used to pop up. It popped up on 7/7, it popped up in the Madrid bombings, it popped up in this and it popped up in that, but now it's pretty much continuous. You open the news headlines every day and there's something about some horrible thing that Muslims are doing somewhere, something that has nothing to do with Islam.
Yes, right, and terrorism and so on. So I'm just saying that if you were to imagine yourself being a 14 to 19-year-old boy in North America, and you remember adding what Don said in terms of the feminization of our culture, and I think that's all worthy of an entire, you know, that's worthy of several shows, that discussion. Mark Stein addressed it very well in his book America Alone, by the way. He talked about exactly that, and he talked about some of its consequences, and I think he's right. I think it is an important factor. But this other one, you could have a perfectly adjusted, well-adjusted, westernized 17-year-old Muslim male who was born here in Canada, and I actually know some like this one in particular I'm thinking of, who then discovers that the government, like, he sees that Islam is now the number one topic everywhere, and so it becomes interesting to him because he's a cultural Muslim and feels that he has some special connection to this group which is being discussed. So he goes to look into whether or not that Islam is what it is he's saying it is or not, and discovers that that Islam is exactly what people like us say it is. And he reads the Quran and he goes to the mosque and discovers that the government, his own government, and certain government-sponsored imams have been lying to his face his whole life. And that, I think, would anger a person and maybe make them, I think that could contribute to them making the decision to become religious Muslims as an active ones, as opposed to just a cultural Muslim who, you know, figures that he has Christmas dinner on Ramadan instead of December 25th or whatever have you. And, you know, that multicultural mosaic stuff, right? I think it's reasonable to think that would, I mean, it would be true for any of us, I'm sure, if whatever it is we considered our ethnic identity had been falsely defined by government for its own interests. Whereas I think if our government did tell the truth about what it was, and nicely, but directly and bluntly, And if we were then and gave people the choice, you know, like you can go do that and be that, and then we're at war with you. Not because we want to, but because you're at war with us. Or you can not. Because it's not like, and this also brings up a really important thing, which I don't think gets discussed enough. I think that a lot of cultural and moral relativists, a lot of leftists try to equate this nonsense of Islamophobia with anti-Semitism and so on. I mean, I think it's important, if you listen to anti-Semites, they're never criticizing the ideology. They're always criticizing the people. And if you listen to Islam critics like us, for instance, we're never criticizing the people. We're only criticizing the ideology. And that if any one of these people were to say, you know what, this is crazy. This Islam thing is completely, it's anti-social, it's anti-progress, it's anti-civilization, I want no part of it. That individual would be okay with us, right? Because it's about the actions that are being taken by people that adhere to this ideology. And that Islamophobia would be much more accurately be associated with Republicanophobia, Gopophobia, I guess, or Demophobia, or... You know, like because we're talking about an ideology here, and that's why I'm saying if you were to treat instead of concerning yourself with Islamophobia, or if governments were to deal with this realistically and be honest, you take a person who's a cultural Muslim and say, well, this, you know, by all means be a cultural Muslim, but the religion itself and the things it teaches are illegal. They aren't. It's not that. It's just that they're at war with Canada. It's that. Their religion makes it absolutely an imperative. It's a religious imperative to be at war with Canada and to be at war with Canada's values. Technically, a religious Muslim can't even be a Canadian. Holding that piece of paper doesn't make them a Canadian, because to be Canadian means more. It doesn't mean that you can't disagree with things, but it means as an overall. There's an overarching set of principles which you adhere to in terms of how you conduct yourself and what values you have. And there's disagreement about how to achieve those values. And yes, I recognize that those values have been shifting thanks to leftism. Again, going back to Don's argument about the feminization of... And by the way, part of me thinks that the winner of that Euro Song Contest, part of me thinks that was just really to piss off Russia. Right? But
and boy, it worked.
Yeah, although I think, you know, it was just more grist for Putin's mill, right? But I do. Part of me did think, oh, that was they just wanted to give the middle finger to Vladimir. So these are again, like our strategies, not just the tactics, but the strategies we're using. And then you look below the surface too, and you see that in many cases and in many countries. Parts of the United States and parts of the American security apparatus, but not all of it. And I think most of the Canadian security apparatus is doing exactly what you would hope it would do, where it's actually going out there and doing all the right things. We're catching tons of people before they do things. Like the number of attacks and large-scale attacks that have been planned in Canada, I think some have actually been pulled off, but we've managed to hide it. Like I think some of these train derailments, suspiciously like what was being planned by, I forget his name, Asana Lagulu, whatever, a couple of these Muslim guys who were busted. One of them was in Ottawa, and he worked for some bioengineering company or something, if you remember that old story. And their website got yanked down.
Oh, I remember split. That.
Oh, yes.
That was a Montreal, wasn't that a Montreal University thing? Where they were doing, they were... They were either working with the national. It was closely affiliated with either the National Research Council or a research lab within a Montreal university. And there was a whole group of them. And when you took a look at their class photo, it was just wall to wall hijabs and beards.
Okay, you're thinking of the exact same photo, but that was actually in Ottawa. That was in Ottawa. That company,
right?
Chesed.
Okay.
It started with C H E S. I think the guy's name. Anyway, so yeah, these. I think our security apparatus is doing sort of what you want them to, except that I don't think we can afford to look at this as a law and order issue. I think what's going to happen is we're going to create our own totalitarian system. It's certainly happened in the States already. In Canada, it may have already happened too, but we're so much more draconian, perhaps, than the Americans that Canadians aren't even aware that our own equivalent of the NSA may be listening to everybody. There may be some kind of giant
Well, Commissioner Paul, you know, with what you're saying there, I'll just jump in there, Vlad, with Commissioner Paulson of the RCMP, there are some troubling facets to the RCMP. I mean, we go back just very, very briefly here. I don't want to steal your thunder here, but very briefly, we take a look at the RCMP as he was public safety minister, now retired member of Parliament, Stockwell Day, at the end of probably about 10 years of decay and degradation, referred to the RCMP as horribly broken. The RCMP has been acting in the last probably 10 years as a law unto themselves. A prime example of that was recently when they were told to dispose of gun registry data. They refused to, and that was in opposition to, and Stephen Harper has been in conflict with the RCMP for quite some time. They try and put a nice face on it and a little bit of lipstick on it, but there's quite a bit of animosity there, specifically because the RCMP acts as a law unto themselves, and evidence of that, and when they started using gun registry data, there was a flood evacuation alert in High River, Alberta, and a few thousand people were moved out of the town. The RCMP saw their opportunity, so when everybody was gone on flood watch, they went around to homes and they were kicking in doors and ransacking houses looking for guns using the gun registry data.
I believe the word you're looking
for is
looting.
Yeah, exactly. Looting. And when you take a look at that, you take a look at the lawless nature of a lot of the RCMP detachments, and just very briefly, they killed Robert Jukanski, a Polish tourist at the Vancouver airport. That killing was determined to be a homicide by the British Columbia coroner, and one officer who went in and committed a second act of murder actually got, I mean, two is too much. I mean, the RCMP can retain you as an employee if you've only murdered one person, but two people is starting to attract a little too much attention. So they fired Benjamin Monty Robinson, but Jerry Rundell, Bill Bentley, and Kwasi Millington are still retained by the force, even though they've engaged in an act of murder. So you take a look at the long line of the long line of lawlessness that the RCMP has become. The fact that that came to the attention of government, and they got a real slap in the face when Harper appointed Commissioner Elliott, a civilian commissioner, to oversee them, more or less babysit them, and all of the senior commanders from Sacredelli to connect to Sukar, they just dug their heels in and provided opposition at every turn. Elliott was then finally backed off and they put another RCMP officer in as commissioner of the RCMP, and that was Paulson. My point is that the RCMP has been lawless and a law unto themselves for a long time, and I imagine now that you've seen the killing of Corporal Cirillo and warrant officer Patrice Vincent, I imagine Paulson is just wetting his pants with anticipation at the new powers that he will gain, which will move them more towards the NKVD and the KGB than they ever have been for. So in sort of a large nutshell, what I'm saying is I agree with your point, Vlad, and it's extremely disturbing that the threat that we face from Islam is being used in an opportunistic fashion by powers that be within Canada to further enhance and further expand on an infrastructure and foundation for a very rigid totalitarian society. I think we've really got to watch what we're doing here in the next few years and keep people like the RCMP on a short leash. I mean, if that's possible.
Well, that's it. That's why I think it would be actually better if we actually admitted that we're at war with Islam. See, you know, we have there's a guy who speaks really frequently on lots of not left-wing media in Canada, a fellow who I have a lot of time and respect for. He's a former chief of strategic planning at CSIS. Now, his name's David Harris, right?
Right. And
David Harris, one of the things he frequently says on his many speaking appearances at CFRA, which is Ottawa's big, not only talk radio station, and he's at least on once a week, what they call the intelligence files, and he's very frequently on Sun TV. And one of the things he very frequently says is that Canadians are going to have to get used to the idea of losing some of their civil liberties temporarily in order to be, parenthetically, because of this fight with Islam, or risk losing them all forever. And see, he's right, but I resent the fact that it's being done in this manner. You must declare war first, and then you say, okay, well, we're going to suspend these civil liberties, and we're going to create a state which no one's going to like for a while, because we need to do this in order to fight this thing. But then you have to be honest about it. You have to, like we did it with the Germans. I'm sure that life wasn't much fun for many people when we were at war with the Germans, because, you know, if you said certain things or did certain things, it was just a much more difficult time. But we did that in order to defeat an enemy, and then we went back to a free and open and democratic society. But what we're doing now appears to be this strange decreasing. It's Brazil-like, you know, the movie.
A perpetual state of war and conflict, and a perpetual state of either orange, red, or blue terror alerts. I mean, it's disturbing. How much time do you have left here? I was going to bring up a point here.
Let me have a look. I think we can go a bit over time. I believe that Red actually really put in we have more time. Go ahead.
Okay. All right, but here's the point. I mean, we're talking, and that for the listeners, this is a little off topic, but it goes to totalitarian societies. In Canada, so just roll with me on this here. I'm not going to fly off on this totally irrelevant tangent. It goes to totalitarian societies, and it was something that that I was reading about that I'm kind of sort of attached to in a legal sense. There's a group of people in Canada called Freemen on the Land. And essentially, they're a collection of people that don't believe in taxation. They don't believe in they believe in taxation in relation to something called magic hats. They believe if they that at birth they're given a social insurance, not a social insurance, some birth certificate number, and that's a form of enslavement. And there's many sort of facets and sides to the ideology of Freemen on the Land. One of the things that they believe is if you spell your name all in capital letters, et cetera, et cetera. Long story short, they don't take kindly to being pulled over by police. They don't take kindly to taxation, et cetera. And they are oft-heard litigants in the local court systems. And they're loathed. They're actually loathed by judges, et cetera, and by court clerks, because these people are, you know, they get caught up in some bylaw officer who wants to ticket them for a white picket fence or something, and it turns into a $250,000 lawsuit or something like that, or action against the particular bylaw officer. But what happened was it came to a head here in Alberta in a case called Mead v. Mead, M-E-A-D-S, and you can look it up on a really decent website called Canlie, C-A-N. LII.org. That's CANLII.org. And it's a referential website, and it has almost every case that's ever been decided by almost every tribunal and court and superior court in Canada. It's a huge, it's a great research tool. Anyway, long story short, the case is called Meads v. Meads, and the judge that adjudicated the matter was an assistant or an associate Chief Justice Rook. And essentially what it was a marital discord between...
Whoops. Hello?
We lost him.
Well, it's just getting interesting. Well, maybe he'll call back in. Okay, so
he's in Canada, so it's not the NSA that did it.
No, it's our own telco, which is probably considerably worse. Let's see if I can just text him. My goodness, what a world we live in. Okay. Oh, is that him? Is that him? You're not 434, right? No.
I am.
Oh, you are. Okay, so well, we'll have to give it another couple of minutes to see what happens. So do you have any thoughts on that, though, in the meantime, or waiting for him to finish his?
Well, his not on, on his. I was thinking of what you were talking about, the government lying to people, because that bears back on the election. It's a general thing. The Islam part of it is just part. The people have been lied to, and you know all the stuff about Obamacare. You can, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. That kind of stuff. They've been lied to and lied to and lied to, and it's a pernicious thing. And once people stop believing that their government is telling the truth, then anything can happen, because you know they hear it, they don't believe it, and even when it's the truth, they don't believe it anymore.
That's right.
And at this point, I quit predicting what can happen, because once people don't believe what their government is telling them, what the media is telling them, what they don't believe anything they can't see and feel in front of them, then anything can happen. And we're approaching that pretty fast, I think.
Well, I think so. These are really extraordinary times. And I have to say that when I first started, again, I started my website, whatever, 8 or 9 years ago, discussions I'd have with people about stuff at a considerably more tame and cautious level than now, I'd be looked at with a great, like as if I was a complete conspiracy theory kook wacko. And now I'm hearing the most...
What, you mean you're not?
Well, I didn't say I wasn't. I didn't say I wasn't. It's just how people looked at me.
Sorry, I didn't mean to distract you.
And now, I mean, I was just out earlier, and I ran into some very, very straight-laced, very conservative, meaning slightly left, but, you know, using conservative in the sense of the going with the norm of the cultural normally views of today. And they were expressing concern about some of these same things, feeling that we're in extraordinary times, and talking about the resurgence of Islam. And these are people that don't read any of our sites, or, you know, just very, very like average people who've worked a straight job their whole life and, you know, raised families and worried about mortgages. It's really quite extraordinary that there is this big attitude shift. And I think it might have been you that said not that long ago, that this is the extraordinary thing about this is it's ground up. I mean, this may be one of the few times in the history of the world where the average person knows more about the problem than the elite, and that any change is going to have to come from the bottom up. And isn't that an extraordinary thing?
Yeah, and that's why they want to control the internet and tax it and regulate it, because that's where the word is getting around. If we were stuck back in the world of network news and radio news and newspapers and stuff, none of what's happening now would be happening quite the same way it is.
That's for sure.
Am I on?
Yes, I think you're back. So did you want to finish that thought, Don?
No, I'll just punctuate the Baron's comments, and absolutely. And just before I go back to Meads v. Meads, just very briefly, I've maintained that the internet is, and I use the term weapon, you know, not in a kind of not in a vigilante sense, but the internet is the greatest weapon to ever been placed in the hands of activists, of citizens, of consumers, and it's viewed by government as a massive threat, and it causes them headache after headache. And if they can silence the internet, if they can somehow draw that blanket of darkness across the globe once more, we're in a lot of trouble. So I hope that never happens. But that said, going back to Meads v. Meads and Freeman on the Land, there's a general view that the Freeman on the Land are sort of this amusing combination of low intelligence and bad dental work that scamper around Canada's hinterland with moonshine, banjos, and having sex with their sisters. But in reality, they're just people that believe very passionately in something. They keep to themselves, and they don't want to be trifled with. And when they are trifled with, they tend to be very ferocious litigators. And some of the stuff they come out with is just right off the wall, like taxation and magic hats, et cetera, et cetera. But here's the point that I was going to make, and it goes back to the totalitarian aspect of our conversation of earlier. Justice Brooke and several of the other justices have determined that because of the frequent litigation that these people and the manner in which they litigate, which can be, you know, somewhat unnerving, they've determined that many of the judges and the lawyers and the court stenographers will remain completely anonymous to these people. I want that to just sink in for a second. Here you have a group of people that object to some of government's practice, you know, some of the judiciary's laws, etc., their processes, and they are extremely, I suppose, vigorous in their opposition to that. And a court has now decided that their cases will be heard by anonymous people. That's anonymous judges with no identity, anonymous court stenographers, anonymous crown prosecutors. Everybody will be anonymous. No names at all will be released to these people. And when I read that,
I got to stop you there and ask you a question. I need to ask. Wait, I need to stop you and ask a question. I'm actually familiar with what you're talking about. I actually had a partner in a former business that was one of these guys in a big way. He believed that just having a driver's license essentially made you a kind of slave, and having identifying plates on your car, the capital letters in your name, that's all the whole thing.
I know.
Most of it sounds completely crazy, but. But he lived that way right up until he took his own life. What I need to know is, you're saying that there's so many of these people, and they've had so much effect that they've actually had to come up with special judicial procedures to deal with them. They've created a whole separate set of rules to deal with people who are part of this group. I mean, I'm stunned.
They're called OPCAs. I think it's called Opportunity Pseudo Legal Commercial Argument. That's the term that they're called, or that's the term that they're referred to by the courts. But yeah, in Canada, they're referred to by now as OPCAs. But they've come up with this new way of dealing with them. And it's actually in effect now, I believe, where they have stripped all references to anybody's name, et cetera, from the court, so these people will be forced to deal with completely anonymous people. Because apparently, subsequent to some of the cases being heard, court stenographers were being sued, court clerks were being sued, crown prosecutors were being sued, judges were being sued, et cetera, and they didn't like that. And so they've decided to go anonymous. The point that I'm trying to make is that when you start doing that to a judicial system, yes, I mean, you lift up a rock, you get all sorts of colorful little bugs running around out from underneath it. That's fine. That's just the way it is. And when you're dealing with a judicial system, in many ways, you're dealing with sort of the sunnier aspects of human nature, from marital discord to jealousy to murder, etc. That's just the way it is. Tolerate it. And in this case, they're dealing with a brand of people who are extremely litigious, and they've decided to close the door on them by remaining completely anonymous. And what bothers me about that is that is so Stalinesque, that's so Star Chamber, that's so Mao Zedong's denouncement trials, etc. It's extremely troubling.
I can see what you mean. I'm surprised they even had that much of an effect, because I would have thought they would just look at these guys and say, that's not a valid argument, that has nothing to do with this, and then ignore it and then find them guilty if they didn't present something reasonable, which makes me think that maybe there's something to what these guys believe. You know?
Well, I mean, you know, the freeman on the land, Justice Brook, and I'm not sure exactly what his leanings are. If his leanings seem to be toward the left, if he's responsible for, drawing a blanket of silence across the court system with respect to particularity and identification. But he described Freeman on the land, one of the characteristics is a belief in God. The other characteristic, a fondness for firearms, you know, just simply possession of firearms. And the other, it was a three-pronged affair. The other one was voting conservative. And when I read that in Needs Be Needs, because it's a 200-page decision that you can download from Canley, and it's actually quite spectacular in its referential nature with respect to the analysis of the freemen of the land. And he actually goes into analyzing many other groups, there's a group that believes in something like tax and the magic hat, and then there's another one called the detaxers. But when I thought about his reference to voting conservative, owning guns, and a faith in God, I was sitting there, I was thinking, how far have we come down the line? These are the kind of people that built this country, that built this, you know, that built North America, and now they're being demonized, villainized for their faith and for their love of hunting firearms and voting conservative. And it smacks of what the Baron was saying earlier in reference to the demonization of the Tea Party and conservatives and the sort of lowest learner in the IRS, and they let her off the hook and she's run amok. And now Bill Whittle just did one recently on another woman and the internet, etc. So it's very disturbing.
Actually, I would say that was all, those objections were all a cover. What really, it's really about demonizing people with a love of liberty and individual liberty. I mean, obviously, that's what it is. It's anybody who doesn't want to be part of the social matrix, which is tightly controlled through shame and humiliation and propaganda. Like anybody who doesn't think recycling is a good idea.
One of the things that I was going to throw in here, I'm going to take, you know, in talking to me, you'll hold on to your, fasten your seatbelts, because we do a lot of 90-degree turns. What I was wondering is if the Baron could step in here and give us an update on Tommy Robinson.
No, I don't really have anything new. As far as I know, he's still inside prison. He was supposedly in for 28 days, and I haven't heard anything for a week or so. Have you heard anything, Vlad?
Not a single word. And I usually, there's periods where I'll get 20 tweets in a row of, you know, valid information, and there's been radio silence for quite a while now.
Yeah.
Well,
I don't know.
Where's he at with the Quilliam Foundation now? Is that gone for naught or what?
Haven't heard much about it. Haven't heard anything since he came out.
The thing is, he's claiming his most recent incarceration is because he was asked to speak at the Oxford station. And I believe that he feels that this has all been a government plot to stop him from appearing as a speaker there, which
the
I'm
Oxford
going to find
Union.
He
said he was going to reveal things about police corruption, that they tried to corrupt him and he'd refused, and he was going to name names. And he says that's why they trumped up this thing against him, because he tweeted about a threat on his life and his family.
It's, you know, I mean, I was a little, I was a little disappointed, and my venom, if you want to put it that way, has been diluted somewhat over a passage of time. But I was not pleased with what I viewed to be a defection by Mr. Robinson from the status quo, his potential. I mean, he's somewhat blue collar and somewhat. Somewhat sort of ordinary in his leadership, but something that appealed to a lot of people in England with the English Defence League. And when he abdicated from that and abandoned that and went off the Quilliam Foundation, I was more than a little unhappy, and I had a lot of very strong things to say about that. But with the passage of time, I look at him and what he's going through now, and I have a tremendous amount of sympathy and empathy, if you want to put it that way. And I'm just hoping that maybe he can step back into that role of leadership. What's your take on that, Baron?
He's got another, let's see, about 8 months until he can do that, because they'll keep putting him back in prison. He got let out on all these conditions that he not partake in political activities, in association with EDL figures, and you know, doing things on social media. So that's why they put him in for this last time. And anytime he makes them unhappy, they'll trump up something and put him back. And he has to wait until the full term of his sentence is passed. And I think that runs out in July of 2015, but I could be wrong on the exact date.
I would very, very much like to hear from a legal expert, ideally a British one, but I'd very much like to hear from a legal expert how speaking at EDL rallies or association with EDL people is in any way makes sense as connected to a mortgage fraud. Like, I don't get it. If they arrested him and jailed him and convicted and jailed him because he had committed some kind of mortgage fraud, and as I understand it, the mortgage fraud he committed, I don't know how familiar people are with the Ayaan Hirsi Ali story, but Ayaan Hirsi Ali was kicked out of the Netherlands because she did what every immigrant did. Like, you get there, they say you got to fill out this form to qualify for entrance to the Netherlands and to qualify for assisted housing, whatever else, you have to say that you are in this position. She said, well, I'm not in that position. Well, if you don't answer that, and by the way, anybody who's ever answered, I mean, what's the job of a civil servant? The job, whenever you're sitting there with any government worker, you say the same question to them, no matter what department it is. What lie do you need me to tell you so that I can get my file off your desk and I can get what I want? That's all any conversation with a civil servant is. So Ayaan Hirsi Ali, she said, well, okay, so you want me to say that I'm this kind of in this situation? Okay, so then she got into the Netherlands, and her story is incredible. And then when she became inconvenient to them because of her position on Islam, they threw her out of the Netherlands on the basis of her not having been entirely accurate on that form, even though that's exactly what it was they told her to do. And everybody understood that.
She's a member of Parliament, isn't she?
She was.
She's a member of Parliament, isn't she?
No, she became one, but now she works for an American think tank, lives in the States. So Tommy Robinson, as I understand it, he did what it is that all British people do to get a mortgage. You all have to tell the same lie. Now, you want to talk about Stalin-esque. Stalin-esque to me is creating a state where you force people to commit a crime to get just to do something normal, like to have a normal life. You put people in a position where they have to commit a crime so you can selectively enforce that law against them on the basis of their politics later on when you need to. So I don't understand how it is that in a free and democratic country, a person who's arrested and jailed on mortgage fraud and then let out on probation with the understanding that they not have certain political associations, that strikes me as, it should be freaking illegal. That should be illegal. Whatever else a person may think of Tommy Robinson, whatever his choices have been or whatever his real actions have been, that doesn't make sense. That cannot be allowed to stand.
In this country, we're in a situation where everybody breaks the law all the time. And you don't know it. You know, there's so many laws in state, federal, local. And so you can... You are then available for manipulation at any moment by anybody who wants to take against you. That's what happened to, what's his name? Is it Dinesh D'Souza? He got prosecuted, and he did whatever, he violated whatever financing rule it was, but people are violating it all the time. They picked on him because they wanted him to put him out of action, and they did.
Yeah, see, that strikes me as being...
How much time do we have left here?
I'd say it's 11 minutes.
Oh, okay. All right.
So that strikes me as being completely Stalin-esque, though, which is that selective enforcement of laws that you forced everybody to break. Actually, I remember an American saying to me once, he was this was back in the 80s, and it was in New York, an American said to me, "Say, what's wrong with you people over there in Canada? What's wrong with you guys?" So what do you mean? He said, "Well, your government, they make you pay such enormous taxes, and they make things so difficult for you people to do any kind of business that you all have to lie and cheat on government forms. What kind of a government puts you in a position where you can't survive unless you break the law?" And I thought about that. This is back again. This would be back under, I think, was it Chrétien? Might have been Chrétien who was... Or might have even been earlier, but he was absolutely right. That's a cancer in democracy when you do that. Why is it we tolerate that? I guess because it's too complicated and because it divides people. Everybody's sort of competing against each other, and we all think, okay, well, it's game theory, right? Like if I break this law, then I can compete in my business, Because I'm going to assume that you aren't breaking that law. But of course you're breaking that law too for the exact same reason, because your business will not succeed if you're doing everything exactly as the law says you will, because no one could afford your product if you did that. It's just crazy to do that. It's a cancer in a free society.
Well, I think one of the things that scares the crap out of a lot of people, and I'll just jump in here, I think what scares the crap out of a lot of people is freedom and self-determination. I think that scares people, the vast majority of people. I think it terrifies people. The thought that you are actually responsible for your own actions, that you are completely in control of your own destiny and your own life, or you should be, and that you are responsible for the stewardship and you're responsible for your own fate. I think that terrifies people. You know, you take a look at big government and it gets to where it is because people are comfortable with being told or a type of person is comfortable with being told what to do, when to do it, where to do it, and how to do it. I mean, I just take a look in the city of Edmonton and I take a look at the amount of policing that we've gotten. It's something that people get used to that they don't notice, but here in the city of Edmonton, we have the RCMP, we have the Edmonton City Police Service, and these are people that are running around all over the place. We have the RCMP, we have the Edmonton City Police Service, then we have a group of people called the Peace Officers, which patrol parks and things like that, but they also do radar checks, stop checks, pull people over. Then we have a group of officers called the bylaw officers, and they run around doing bylaw work and writing parking tickets. Then we have a group of people called, there's the sheriffs as well, I think I mentioned them. And then each individual institution, like the University of Alberta, has their own police force, Northern Institute of Technology, they've got their police force, etc. We are one of the most heavily goddamn police cities in North America, and nobody seems to sit here and stand back and say, this is ridiculous, this is absolutely insane. And when you bring it up to people, they say, well, yeah, but they're keeping us safe. I mean, it's insanity on a whole, on a completely Olympic level.
Yeah, I mean, what are we going to do about it, right? We're going to have to come up with some good strategies and some good ideas that all of us can do. I mean, well, certainly disseminating information is a good thing, but...
Well, it doesn't matter who you vote for, at least not in this country, generally speaking.
Well, I mean,
it doesn't.
You take a look at what's happening in Alberta, and if you suggest to the average person on the street, I mean, I'm not coming at it from a... any one particular political standpoint, but if you talk to people and you say, listen, do we really need all of this policing in the city? I mean, it's costing hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. And I'm not sure what it is. It's disturbing, I'll say that. But,
well, you're
going to
need it when the city of Edmonton decides to start prosecuting people that are as critical of Islam for a hate crime. You are going to need that much policing.
Oh, well, I mean, the police here in Edmonton and in Calgary, and we had that conversation on your show here a few weeks ago, when we were talking about the incoherence and the absolute illiteracy of most police officers with respect to Islam and the emergence of Islam, with respect to Islam and the impact that it's having on North America and its attempt to essentially grab controls of the ship of state. When you speak to police officers here, they're purposely kept in a state of denial. They're purposely kept in this fog of incomprehensible, sort of rudderless, babbling incoherence with respect to the, you know, being able to speak the name of the actual threat itself. And it's quite disturbing. And I think the dividends of that foolishness is being wrought in the fact that Alberta is now jihadi farm team number one in Canada. We're in a lot of trouble. I mean, I don't know if it's going to go that way, though. I mean, Vlad, you make a disturbing but excellent point. At what point are we going to start criticizing being prosecuted for criticizing Islam here in Alberta or in Edmonton and Calgary?
Well, as soon as they can figure out exactly how to word it. I mean, one of the tricks that's been played on people in free countries across the world was to create laws that run directly across the spirit and letter of freedom of speech laws, but to make them sound like a good idea by claiming that speech that you don't like is actually hate speech or whatever have you. All these things are really quite pernicious and very brilliant. And it's just a matter of
finding out how to work. And terrorism. Don't forget terrorism.
Yes, exactly, because terrorism doesn't mean Muslims acting in the name of Islam to go kill as many people as possible in order to put people into a state where they're susceptible to being put under Sharia law. Terrorism means objecting to that.
Yeah. No.
Right. It's like Stalin said.
It's Orwellian in its overtones. You know, I mean, you know, Mr. Orwell was right on the money. It's disturbing to say the least. Just give both of you a short answer. Where do you think we are? Do you think we're winning or do you think we're losing?
Oh, I think we're winning. It's just it's hard to see. I think the wind's blowing in our direction. But we have to wait till the currencies collapse before things will change. Everything is being kept. All the hollow shell of things is being held together by the international currency system, and as long as that holds in place, that's the whip that everybody can be kept in line with. If you look at all the things that happen to people, it's fear of losing their livelihoods, not guys kicking down their doors and pointing guns at them, but fear of losing their livelihoods that motivates people to keep quiet, to shut up, to stop doing anything resembling resistance.
So if I'm hearing you right, you're saying we're winning, but the outward appearance of things is going to get much worse before it begins to get better.
Well, yeah, and I also think that a lot of the what's going to happen is hard to predict because of all that. I've often said that back in 2008, the late 2008, early 2009, people were predicting the financial collapse imminently. Do you remember that? You know, some of them are, I don't want to name names and piss people off, but some of them are still out there, prominent bloggers and writers, making their new predictions. Everything's going to go to hell in the next 6 months. But that's what they were saying 6 years ago, and they were wrong. And I learned my lesson. I'm not making any specific predictions. All I can say is that things can't continue the way they are for indefinitely.
Well, I just got the 90-second warning from the little automated voice in the studio, and that was 25 seconds ago. So I'd just like to take these last few seconds to thank you both very much for coming on the show and being so excellently informative. It's really appreciated, and I think a lot of people appreciate knowing that there's these discussions are taking place and that they can listen to them as they want to and need to. I think people need to know that there are those of us out there that are discussing it. It's important to have a sense of community when you feel that you are being closed in on from so many sides like this. And certainly we've illustrated in what ways that's taking place. On the one hand, that could make you feel worse by feeling some despair and that there is no direction in which you can turn that's safe. But on the other hand, I hope it would bring hope to know that people are discussing it and that by awareness of it, you stand a better chance of standing up to it. We're at the 5-second mark now, so I'm going to wish you both a good night and thank you both very much for being on the show.
Good night, Vlad.
You're welcome, Vlad. You bet. Good night.